The conversation continues with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk TNT.
And good morning and welcome to Wednesday on the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk TNT. You know it's the place to be. Hey, my old rapping days, I was never a rapper. Good morning to you all. I hope you're all fantastically well. Good morning in the comments and on every platform that is receiving us, whether that is X or Instagram or Rumble or YouTube or right here on TNT. Do not go anywhere for the next 2 hours and preferably for the rest of the day. So coming up on today's show, we ask if Rishi Sunak is now on a war footing as he announces the biggest increase on defence spending for a generation. We'll also look very sadly at the migrant deaths in the Channel yesterday and consider what can be done to end such tragedy. And Professor Angus Dalgliesh will be joining us in the last hour to talk about his latest findings and the latest findings regarding the mRNA vaccine. Now, it's curious to me on the day that BBC presenter Hugh Edwards is on the front pages about him leaving the BBC after allegations of him giving £35,000 to a crack-addicted teen, an even bigger and frankly implausible BBC story overshadows Hugh's departure. It's about TV presenter Jill Dando, whose murder is 25 years this week. Can you believe that? The 25th anniversary. For those who don't know, Jill was huge in the UK. She was, as the headline says, considered to be the girl next door to TV fans. And some backstory. She was a BBC broadcaster. She was 37 when she was gunned down on the steps of her West London house on April the 26th, 1999, at a approximately 11:30 in the morning. She was killed with a single muffled bullet to the skull, and a friend found her on her doorstep in a crime that shocked Britain. It was one of those ones that you sort of remembered where you were when you heard that Jill Dando had died. Part-time stuntman Barry George was jailed for the killing in 2001, but his conviction was overturned in August 2008 following the emergence of fresh evidence. She was found by her friend, TV producer Helen Doble, who lived two streets away from Jill in Fulham, southwest London. And Helen said she knew immediately that Jill was dead, but did not go anywhere near her because she also knew she should not be disturbing the crime scene. But the fact is, the crime scene was messed up from the beginning, and it started when the police arrived. Helen has previously recalled how she later met the police chief investigating Jill's murder, Detective Chief Superintendent Hamish Campbell. She claims he told her Jill's fame could have impacted on the response of the emergency services, who possibly contaminated the crime scene upon arrival. Helen added, "He said to me things happened at the scene which shouldn't happen, and things didn't happen which should have, and that sadly because of who she was, that had a bearing on it. My reading of what he was saying is that paramedics and police would not have rushed in if it hadn't been Jill Dando. And in doing so, the crime scene was contaminated. Any forensic evidence was lost then." Yes, that's right. Forensic evidence lost right at the beginning, which is fairly shocking, right? So how can this death in broad daylight remain unsolved all these years later? Well, Jill has resurfaced on the front pages this week because one of the most implausible theories looks like media and whoever is determined to make it real. That is of a Serbian hitman assassinating her after she fronted a crisis appeal for those fleeing from the Balkans. Now, if you believe that, you will probably believe anything. There's lots of theories around Jill's death. There's the IRA theory. There is the stalker theory, of course. There's always a chance it was a common or garden stalker. When you are a public figure, you can attract proper weirdos. Trust me, I know. But there's more theories. There was David Copeland, the London nail bomber. There was also said to be a royal involvement. As an aside, by the way, an interesting royal connection to the case is Jill's fiance, Alan Farthing, who went on to become the royal gynecologist and deliver the royal babies after Jill's death. But the theory that, to my mind, has the most legs is that Jill was murdered because she was about to bust an establishment paedophile ring linking her BBC colleague Jimmy Savile to royals and politicians. And an anonymous staffer came out in 2014 and claimed that the Crime Watch presenter had been on the verge of exposing a VIP paedophile ring when she died. So no, I highly doubt that the Serbian hitman is Jill Dando's killer, not based on my research anyway. And I made a film called Paedophiles in Parliament, but it's convenient to say it is, right? And especially right now when the BBC and their toxic, egregious ways are back under the spotlight with Hugh Edwards. Now, our question of the day, what makes you feel patriotic? And you can call us here. Here's the numbers.
This is the way we're going to be heard.
From the U.S. and Canada, call 1-888-201-6425. From the U.K., call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And good morning, Gemma Cooper. It's hump day. We've arrived, Gemma.
We have indeed. And I've got a good news story for hump day. I'll leave it till last. It's one of the headlines that broke late last night in the UK. And I thought we've got to talk about that just a tiny bit tomorrow. You know, we focus on doom and gloom, but there's a tiny little headline that I thought, yes, people power. Anyway, I'll get to it in a minute. Funny about Jill Dando, I remember exactly where I was when the news came through that Jill Dando had been murdered. I'd not long started my own career in journalism. I was in the office of a big daily paper. It was lunchtime, wasn't it? I remember that very well indeed. And funny enough, I've worked with Jill Dando's brother. I know him well from my days at the BBC. And funny enough, I bumped into him not long ago. He lives in my neck of the woods. And he just made a Netflix special. I'm sure it was Netflix or Amazon, something like that, about the killing. And we chatted for a long time. I've never raised any of those theories about the paedophile ring, anything with him. He is convinced it was Barry George. He is convinced. He's got no doubt in his mind that the original conviction is the one that he wanted to see kept. Loads of theories. Funnily enough, Richard D. Hall, a friend of both of ours, he's always gone down the Serbian hitman route. That's been his line of research. We'll never know. That's the thing. We will never know on any of this. But certainly, I mean, the original conviction, I mean, well, he was kind of a homeless guy. How do you perform what was obviously a professional state-of-the-art hit with a silencer in broad daylight? You know, that does have obviously all the hallmarks of somebody who really did know what they were doing. And nobody saw anything.
That was a professional hit job. 100%. Yeah. That was a professional hit job. No doubt about it whatsoever. They knew that she was going to be there in that short window. She'd spent the night before with her fiance. She was just returning home for a brief period. They knew where she was going to be and when they'd followed her. And that was professional hit. Absolutely. So, but I agree with you. I doubt for one second we will ever know. But the fact is I think that we should, to a degree, give credence to the idea that a BBC colleague whistleblew and said, no, she came out, she gave a dossier, she was going to blow the whistle on a paedophile ring, because we now know about Jimmy Savile and his links to the establishment. So I think to a degree, there is credibility to that. But again, as you say, we'll probably never know.
Yeah, and something doesn't add up there, that she was the only person. I mean, obviously this whistleblower knew. So what did the whistleblower know? Can the whistleblower blow the whistle on the ring? You know, there's not enough evidence for it. That's the problem. She might have been, but there's no actual real evidence except an alleged whistleblower who obviously might know something but isn't disclosing the facts. It does, journalistically, it doesn't add up. The only thing that does add up is a professional hit in broad daylight that nobody saw in a very small window. Like you say, that's where the original, I think, conviction should have fallen down, because who's got the nous to get trained to that level of assassination? And not your common or garden, you know, former stuntman. It doesn't work like that. But like you say, we'll never know. Never know.
Oh, the Barry George story, though, is actually tragic. He was a loner. He was struggling already anyway. Highly demonized. They came after him. What they believed he was about was just, I don't for a second think that he was the guilty party. But
No, me neither. I don't either. Interesting, though, that Jill Dando's brother, you know, we've had the conversation face to face just a few weeks ago. He said, no, I'm convinced it was Barry George. That's, you know, so everybody, even those closest to the case, You know, if your sister was murdered by a professional Serbian, you'd want answers.
Right.
But he's convinced it's, you know, Barry George. But everybody sees the world in a different way, don't they, Sonia? And he's a lovely guy. Her brother is a lovely, lovely man.
And just to say, somebody did actually confess to it. William Aird, an IRA hitman, said the IRA were behind it. But we also know that there are issues with people making false confessions. There are all manner of reasons why people make false confessions, sometimes just for attention. But I digress. Gemma, what's going on with the UK headlines today?
Well, Rishi Sunak, he's off around Europe warmongering. You'd say, is he putting Britain on a war footing? Yes, he absolutely is. Of course, we had that massive announcement yesterday that he will be spending 2.5% of GDP by 2030. That's £75 billion. And they're going to cut some civil service jobs to do that, which many are applauding, actually, saying the civil service is ripe for reform. So yesterday he was in Poland, where he made that announcement. Today he's off to Germany to meet the German Chancellor and usher in a new era of defence collaboration between the two nations. This is a bit left field. I don't think anybody in the UK has asked him to really do this. I wasn't aware that the UK felt that strongly. You know, we were facing a recruitment and retention crisis in our armed forces. I don't think anyone's interested in the military anymore, but he's in Germany today, continuing his efforts to drum up profitability for arms manufacturing. Moving across to France after the tragedy yesterday in the Channel, the French authorities are under strong criticism now today for allowing the boat with 112 migrants on it to carry on sailing after the five people, including that little seven-year-old girl, died. So questions are being asked there as why that boat was allowed to carry on. And the good news story for Hump Day, Sonia, Wales is to drop its 20-mile-an-hour blanket speed limit across the country. It's admitted it's gone wrong, hideously wrong for the Welsh government. So the new government that's come in to replace Mark Drakeford, still Labour, they have said it works outside schools, but for the rest of the routes, most of the other routes, it has not been appropriate. I think the Welsh people could have told them that. I think they did tell them that. So there we are, good news story for Hump Day here on TNT.
That is indeed a good news story. We like that. But we're going to drill down on not such a good news story, right?
Well, Rishi Sunak, he's already leaked, his Downing Street have leaked some of the details of what will be discussed today with the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz. He says he's opening up a new chapter in defence and security. The two countries will jointly develop new artillery systems, creating hundreds of jobs for both nations, and also equipping both German and UK troops with cutting-edge capabilities for future ground warfare. Now, this is ramping up once again something we've talked about a lot here on TNT, which is this preparing us mentally, this predictive programming for some kind of World War III-esque, you know, venture. So he's aligning with Poland yesterday, he's aligning with Germany today. You know, who would have thought that UK and Germany after the Second World War would be standing shoulder to shoulder, but they're standing shoulder to shoulder against Russia. Rishi Sunak is very clear on that. He says UK and Germany are both powerhouses and together we are stronger. We are going to be definitely, whether that is defending against Russian aggression, there we go. And again, that rhetoric there about Russia, or driving economic growth. Again, we're talking about profits for, arms manufacturers here. We're talking about corporate profits or technological advancement. He says today we were opening up a new chapter in our relationship that will make us all safer and more prosperous. And he says this is a dangerous moment for the world. Again, this rhetoric we've been hearing for the last few months, and the UK and Germany need to stand side by side to preserve our security and prosperity at home and across the European continent. Of course, this comes after yesterday's landmark announcement about £75 billion for defence spending. But it doesn't add up with the picture at home. We were talking about conscription just a few weeks ago and months ago, and nobody wants to fight. Nobody wants to sign up. Nobody wants to go to war. And suddenly, here we are on the world stage, you know, warmongering, allying with Europe to ramp up spending against this alleged Russian threat. And all this programming here, fear-based programming to prepare us for some kind of global conflict. So it's an interesting one. I wonder where I'll go next. And I'm surprised it's not David Cameron, our unelected foreign secretary. It's Rishi Sunak on the foreign stage announcing all of this stuff that I don't think is an election issue. I could be wrong. I could be wrong, but I'm not sure the interest in the military here in the UK is quite worthy of the money that's being thrown at it. But there we go.
Thank you, Gemma. So that's Gemma Cooper for you, giving us good news with one hand and taking it away with the other. We will see you, Gemma, in the next hour. We'll discuss the increase in defence spending with William Clouston, leader of the Social Democratic Party, right after the break.
Los Angeles has been described as a suburb looking for a city. Join me as we explore LA's neighbourhoods and the local restaurants, cafes and bars that are an integral part of these vibrant and diverse communities.
Today we are going to cook a small steak for people who are really quite hungry.
Very, very simple. A couple squeezes of lemon in there.
Since you're adding the meat, and you can do also do it with tofu options as well for the vegetarians.
Olive oil. So now we're going to season it up. Fresh grind black pepper.
Really hot and busy in here.
I'm going to go ahead and make some buttered toast.
Olive oil.
Ah, really smells good.
Grab our shiitake mushrooms.
Season with salt a little bit.
Boy, it's getting hot in the kitchen. Need another drink of my beer. Ah, that's the best part of cooking.
And we are ready to put our plate together.
Add the mussels right around the rim. See, we have really nice colors, nice piece of fish.
We just need to add a little bit of powder sugar.
And I will just put a little bit of reduction glaze over the top.
When you add a pesto like this onto a braised meat, the smells that just come up are just wonderful. Take it from me, we've got a good thing going here.
Not see it coming. It's pre-diabetes, and it captures one in three adults. You may not even know you have it, but you can escape. Take the 1-minute pre-diabetes risk test to know where you stand. With early diagnosis, you can change the outcome and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Be your own hero on smartphones everywhere at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Today's News Talk Radio.
I do a lot of streaming radio.
I do a lot of free streaming.
TNTradio.live.
Keep your comments coming in. Lovely people, Five Eyes on X says, looks like a great lineup today. Rest in peace, Jill Dando. Assassinated, sends a message, ? The paramedics and police disturb crime scene, destroying evidence, calculated. We're supposed to believe that these professionals were too excited over her fame, thus overriding their training. These are all good questions, Five Eyes, all good questions. Now, Rishi Sunak has promised billions more for defence to counter threats from what he describes as an axis of authoritarian states. The Prime Minister said UK military spending would rise to 2.5% of national income by 2030 and stressed that the UK was not on the brink of war, but claimed that the extra money would put the country's defence industry on a war footing. But with an election looming, does this also give the Prime Minister the added ammunition for the battle ahead? Joining me with his thoughts on this and more is William Clouston, leader of the Social Democratic Party. Good morning, William.
Morning.
I'm interested, William, do you think that with this announcement, Rishi Sunak has strengthened his electoral chances?
Not really, no. I don't think it makes much difference. And in any case, he's very unlikely to be the person that implements this. It's SDP policy to increase defence spending up to 2.5%. So it's probably a good idea, but he has grave difficulty. Any government is going to have grave difficulty in implementing this, given the state of the UK's public finances. Remind the viewers that the current PSBR, the borrowing requirement, is over 120 billion. So it's going to be a challenge. And I would say, in terms of defence spending, it's not just about how much we spend, it's how we procure equipment. There are cultural aspects that are important as well. So it's not just about money.
Would you say that he's made the UK a safer place with this announcement, William?
No, I don't think it makes very much difference, because I think in any case, it's going to be ramped up. You will not get from 2.1% to 2.5% overnight. Any government, I think Starmer has made a similar commitment, and any government's going to take time to do it. But the real problem that we have is not just how much we spend. There have been a string of procurement disasters, and basically we bought the wrong kit. The Navy has two very, very large aircraft carriers that it has difficulty putting to sea. And if they do go to sea, we lack the surface vessels to protect them. And in any case, that procurement was done not with regard to homeland security, which I think we should prioritize rather than foreign adventures, but to be part of a much bigger system. And I think there's too much American domination in how we procure. And as I say, the industrial capacity we have in the UK needs to be built up. We need to be much more self-reliant. So those questions are, I would say, as important as the actual amount you spend.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? We've been repeatedly told over the years that there's no magic money tree, yet here's $75 billion from where? I mean, where has this money come from, William?
Great question. No, I mean, it doesn't... If you're running deficits of the order we're doing, this is going to be extremely challenging. And when asked, most Tories would say, well, we'll find savings elsewhere and, you know, we'll cut the civil service and we'll cut this and that. But basically, this is a problem across all spending departments. You know, we don't spend it. We don't invest enough in housing. We don't invest enough in infrastructure or public transport. And there are many, many demands. You know, and what we've got ourselves into in this economy, because we've deindustrialized, is we've destroyed our tax base, basically. And so it's going to be increasingly difficult for governments to satisfy these things. I mean, I would say, Sonia, the viewers listening to an announcement like this, how many of you actually believe that it'll be fully fulfilled?
Right. What would be the SDP policy regarding Ukraine?
Well, I think we were the only party that at the outset, in a press release when the war started just over 2 years ago, actually flagged up the danger of counter-sanctions. So, you know, Liz Truss and the government at the time are saying, we will put sanctions on, we will do this and that. There's very little debate about the cost to the West of Russia's sanctions against us, effectively. And as a full, they underestimated the power of Russia, I think, in terms of its commodity power. It's a full spectrum commodity superpower. Many of the things it's exporting are fungible and can be exported elsewhere. It's not just the case of cutting off gas to the West and particularly German economy. It's the effect of the rest of the world not taking sanctions seriously. So Western policy actually on Ukraine has not been successful to date, and I think we're in a very dangerous situation. Another thing that I detect in many Western politicians is just a lack of realism, I'm afraid. I am a nation-state Democrat. I think Russia's invasion of Ukraine is deplorable. But there is also a realist position, which is, do you honestly believe that Russia is going to be expelled by military force from every single part of Ukraine that it occupies? I personally do not believe that's likely.
I also wanted to get your thoughts on the tragic deaths in the Channel yesterday, William. Three men, a woman, a seven-year-old girl. Are we ever going to solve this issue?
We can solve it. It is a tragedy. Every single time these things happen, I despair really of those that govern us. We can solve it, but you have to elect a government that wants to solve it. And putting it crudely, we have to change the incentives. At present, our government incentivizes people to turn up unsolicited on the coast, unchecked, unvetted. Why? Because most of them stay here. Most of the grant rate for asylum in this way is very high. Deportations are very low. So if you actually get here, you've got a very, very good chance of staying here. And until that incentive changes, the flow will continue to increase. The way you change the incentive is by adopting SDP policy, basically, which is to any unsolicited arrival will be transported off to Ascension Island, which is an island we control, will be detained there, and will never be granted asylum in the UK. Will either stay there or be deported back to the country of origin or back to a third country. If you implemented that, the flow would stop overnight. The problem
is that Is that true, though, William? And the reason I say that is, of course, that the Rwanda bill has now gone through, but that hasn't been a deterrent to people arriving on the small boats.
It can't be, because it's far too small, Sonia. The maximum capacity of Rwanda would be a couple of thousand people. And on the numbers, you're not going to deter 70 or 80,000 illegal entrants with that. I mean, the chances, the prospects are still that you won't go to Rwanda. In any case, it fetters our policy to a third state. What happens if Rwanda changes its government and changes its mind? And thirdly, it leaves, the government have left the legal architecture in place, the HRA, the ECHR, and the post-war protocols. They've left that in place such that any arrival will have grounds to claim. So basically, until you change those things, the flow will continue. I can promise you, Sonia, people will not spend 5,000 euros. They will not bribe smugglers that amount of money to arrive on the south coast and immediately be transferred to Ascension Island and then to back to where they came
from. Right, so they have to be sent the message that this is serious. This is not just going to keep flip-flopping in and out of parliament. That's what you're saying, really, isn't it? Is that people aren't taking it. I get you. Thank you so much, William, for joining us this morning, giving us clarity on incredibly important issues. Everybody, this is William Clouston. He's the leader of the Social Democratic Party. Here are the news headlines. We'll be right back.
Today's News Talk Radio.
We do have some big news.
What is it?
Yeah, what is it?
What is it?
Now, TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Months after he was forced off air over a sordid sex photo scandal involving a teenage boy, disgraced British newsreader Hugh Edwards has officially resigned from the BBC. The UN Human Rights Chief says he's been left horrified by the discovery of mass graves outside two hospitals in Gaza. And the US Senate has approved a bill that would ban TikTok in the country if its China-based parent company ByteDance refuses to sell.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT Radio. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk. It's Wednesday. It's 24th of April. Where has this year gone, people? Tell me, where has this year gone? And a reminder of our question of the day. What makes you feel patriotic? I'll start. What makes me feel patriotic is being welcoming, embracing to other people, perhaps less fortunate. That probably sets me apart from many other people, but so what? I'm not a tremendously patriotic person. I'm a woman of the world, shall we say. And don't forget, please tell us what you feel makes you patriotic. Very personal thing. And right, let us go to our next guest. I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Gavin Ashton, and we're going to be discussing an intriguing story. Last year, the Church of England declared that it had invested the modern equivalent of 440 million in the slave trade between 1720 and 1740, and would make amends for this by paying out 100 million in a programme of reparations. Beg my pardon. However, historian of that period, Professor Richard Dale, has now said that this is based on a mistake and that the church did not invest anywhere near such sums in the slave trade and certainly didn't profit from it. This is getting curious. Joining me to discuss this is Dr. Gavin Ashton, author, columnist and editor of the Catholic Herald. Good morning, Gavin.
Good morning. Hello.
This is extraordinary. I read this story and it's like, okay, what is actually going on here? What do you make of the church's grasp of history, Gavin?
Well, it's like that of an adolescent child who's about to sit his exams and hasn't done any homework. It's the imposition. It's the worst kind of fundamentalism, because it's basically that they had an idea which they then ran with. And didn't even look at the evidence. Actually, if I can correct what you said, just to be a pedant for a moment, you said it hadn't invested anything like that. Well, you said it hadn't invested anything like that amount of money. It turns out it hadn't invested a single penny of money, not a single penny, because just to explain to your readers, it turns out that in the 18th century, the slave trade was a dangerous investment. And so it was high risk. So high risk meant high returns. But what Parliament decided was it was too high risk for the church's money to be put in. So it ring-fenced the church's money and said, you can't invest in any of this. You have to invest in low returns, low yield, safe stuff, nothing to do with the slave trade. So not a single penny went into the slave trade.
Extraordinary. I hear you. And the reason I find that particularly extraordinary is because obviously we're discussing this because last year the church commissioners who run the Church of England's investments, they published this report which said that the bounty had invested the rough equivalent of 440 million, you know, in today's money in the slave trade in via that the South Sea Company. And you're saying not one penny of that is true. That is extraordinary.
Well, that's why this historian got so cross and wrote it, because he said, first of all, you should have peer-reviewed it. In academic terms, a peer review is when somebody writes something and then you put it out to your colleagues who are as clever and as informed as you to make sure that they agree you haven't made a mistake. So the first thing that the church ought to have done is to behave like grown-up intellectuals and said, just check this out, guys. But it didn't do that. It's a failure of process at the most basic level. And then secondly, as it happened, because this happens in life sometimes, the facts were against them. Not for the same ethical reasons. It was all about financial prudence, not about ethics. So Parliament gets no brownie points for being good. It just gets brownie points for being clever. They decided that the church's money simply wasn't allowed to be invested in this risk business. So it's completely extraordinary. But what it means is we're being run by children. Who are dogmatic fundamentalist children who prefer to feel good about themselves rather than actually do their jobs. And it's really alarming. Where are the grown-ups in the room? There aren't any.
Absolutely. Gavin, I think they just entered the room. And this does need to be a grown-up talk because it's incredibly emotive for anybody from all sides of this argument, isn't it? So do we actually know what was the real scale of the church's involvement in the slave trade?
Yeah, zero.
Really? I mean,
yeah, no, zero. Well, okay, so if you're on the other side of it, I was discussing this in the pub last night after a choir practice of a group I sing with.
That's an interesting statement just there, Gavin. I particularly like it, yes.
I was discussing it with a rather competent accountant who I sing with, and he's got nothing to do with the church. And we were talking about the concept of dirty money. So he said, effectively, there were some people who gave money to the church because they were rich. And as it happens, they were rich because they'd made some money personally out of slave investments. That's true. So if you have the concept of dirty money, then they had used some of their wealth in charitable giving to the church. But the problem is, so this was independent, private, not corporate, as the church is saying here. But the problem with dirty money is that it's an extension of this leftist idea of guilt by association. So, for example, If someone says, Gavin, what are you doing talking to TNT? You're a bad man. They're bad people. We're never talking to you again.
Got you. And okay, Charles Yes, go on.
Well, just one more step, because there's a very beautiful poem about a £5 note, a five-franc note written by a French worker priest in the 1960s. And he traces this five-franc note through a whole load of people. He traces it through a philanthropist, through a prostitute, through a baker. You know, this note gets paid for a whole series of people. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. And he says, is there anything wrong with this five-franc note? Has it done anything? Should you not receive it? Is it tainted? And it's a rather beautiful poem. And he says, no, you can't taint money like that. You can either use it for good or bad. So in this particular case, these rich people had invested in the slave trade, bad, taken their money, given it to poor people, good. But that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the money. What it means is people have mixed motives and mixed lives. Again, it's a piece of really silly fundamentalism to say, money can have guilt by association. It's actually quite bad to say people can, but it's really stupid to say money can. So the church has done this as well. Yeah,
I take your point. And obviously the story we're talking about is Charles Moore. And what he actually said was the use of linked in that context is a really Weasley way to use it.
Yeah,
because linked is one of those words, isn't it, that many charlatans use to make outrageous claims. And I know that some people who purport to be researchers, for example, they come up with these outrageous, ideas about how something it is. And oftentimes it's because there is this sort of kind of dubious link that they probably don't even know about. Some sort of business interest as one perfect example. But do you think that the church is right in making any form of reparations on this?
It's wrong at every single level. So first of all, there was no investment, no money at all was made. Secondly, as you quite rightly say, the linked argument is spurious and very weak. Thirdly, again, it's following a piece of leftist dogma, which is that people identify collectively and historically. So if there were some slaves today who had been set free and the church had been involved in their incarceration, it should and could make reparation. But the moment it goes, they're dead, you're not doing it to them. You might do it to representatives. You might want to do it, I suppose, as a symbolic act of goodwill. But to do it 25 generations later, it's just bonkers. And it's all about, effectively, what lies behind this is, having given up Christianity, people need religion. And so if you've got a good religion, you'll make a bad one. And they've taken this idea of moral virtue politically, and they've turned it into a fundamentalist religion because they want to feel good about themselves. This is just about people who should be Christians but aren't, feeling good about themselves, having invented a new religion to do it.
Oh, virtue signalling. We absolutely loathe that around here. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, everybody. Dr. Gavin Ashenden, he is an associate editor of the Catholic Herald, and he's telling us exactly why the whole thing appears to be bonkers and based on a lie. We will be right back. Thank you for joining us, Gavin.
From weather and traffic reports to news of political developments, we turn to journalists for the information we need to live our daily lives.
Journalists around the world provide the news that is essential for democracy,
for personal freedom, and for safety and stability.
Yet their ability to report freely and safely is under attack like never before.
So many journalists are paying with their lives.
They face exponential risks, and they've already paid a heavy toll.
Death threats, online harassment, and physical attacks
are becoming a daily experience of journalists in all countries.
We just want people to be safe, to be able to get our readers the information that they need to make informed decisions.
They checked my phone and realized that it was Pegasus. I feel myself like I'm naked at the street.
These charges were politicized from the start.
Facts win. Truth wins. Justice wins.
C'est énorme pour moi d'être là, d'être libre. Surtout que je m'y attendais pas du tout.
Stand with a free press. Stand with journalists whose reporting won't be silenced. Press freedom is your freedom.
I'm your retirement fear, but don't be scared. You're still in pre-retirement.
Does that mean I have more time to plan?
Precisely. Here, this is pretirement.org.
Retirement savings options? Potential tax breaks?
Boom.
This isn't scary. I'm doing it.
You got this.
Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan.
Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
Now, welcome back. Joining us now for a roundup of some of the day's biggest stories is political commentator Chloe Dobbs. Good morning, Chloe.
Morning, Sonia. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us as ever. And we've been talking about defence spending this morning. $75 billion by 2030. Money well spent, Chloe.
I think so. I think it is about time. I think there's been a lot of complacency because we've had several decades of relative peace since the Cold War. Most people, especially people my age, you haven't really lived through many hot periods in terms of wars and whatnot are not really aware of the potential issues that we could face. They're not used to that sort of thing. So I think it is about time. The world is hotting up. I think we really do need this money. And I think what the government had said before, which was we will increase defence spending when economic conditions allow. I mean, when are economic conditions going to allow? That could be never. We're always going to have economic problems. So that was quite worrying. So to have an actual date attached to it is quite good.
I mean, it's interesting the date that they've attached to it, 2030. It's also the UN Sustainable Development Goal date as well. So I always find it, whenever I see anything with 2030 on it, it always feels a bit like it's all connected. Do you get that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a multiple of 10. It's a nice round number that they can often choose. Now, 2030, that, of course, is well after the general election where most of us suspect Keir Starmer is going to win. So the Conservatives have made this pledge, but it's very much up to Keir Starmer to stick to it. Now, we've seen Keir Starmer come out in recent weeks defending our nuclear deterrent and saying that he's going to invest. But you've got to remember, this is Keir flip-flop Starmer, who will say whatever is popular. If it becomes the case that defence spending is no longer popular in the future, you know, Ukraine spending has become quite controversial just because people say, look, we've got horrible cost of living crisis here. We can't make ends meet. Give us the money instead, please. If it becomes the case that defence spending is no longer popular, I don't trust Keir Starmer not to flip-flop and go back to his days of supporting Corbyn, who wanted to get rid of the nuclear deterrent, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's a really divisive subject because many people are like, we can always find money for war, but we can't find money to feed people adequately or make sure that their homes are heated. And I do think that we have many issues with that. Now, let us look at something else. Obviously, yesterday was St. George's Day. A St. George's Day rally descended into chaos when protesters clashed with police in central London. It's led many to accuse police of that two-tier policing policy that we've heard about so much, suggesting that the similar thing happened with the pro-Palestine marches. What are your thoughts about what happened yesterday, Chloe?
I think it's definitely two-tier policing. I think one thing I will add is that we need to understand the context of what went on here. It's quite hard for people who just see that sort of 30-second clip on Twitter to actually understand what was going on. Now, most of the day was all completely peaceful, everybody respectful. It's not the case that you had fights breaking out all the time. You've just got one little snippet here. And all that happened is you had a load of people with their Ingham flags all walking down the street. And all of the sudden, the police, they blockaded people from proceeding down the road. They blocked the road with police vans and had sort of a barrier of police officers stopping people from coming through. And they were there for ages and everybody was getting agitated because nobody actually knew why the police were stopping them from continuing to walk down the road. So people got a bit agitated and then you got a bit of pushing and shoving and people trying to get through the police barrier. And then you got this sort of immense police reaction where they brought the horses in and sort of pushed the horses into the crowd. And you know, there are a lot of people there and the horses pushed into quite a tight space. There's a good chance that someone would have their foot stepped on by a horse, which I don't think would be fun. So I think it was a bit of an overreaction in that sense. But this was just a little 30-second snippet. But I think what the real story here is that you compare this to how the police have behaved at the Palestine protest, and it's very clear that you've got two-tier policing. So we just had at the weekend, we had Gideon Falter, the chief executive of Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, told by the police, we will arrest you if you do not leave the area because you are openly Jewish. And that is a breach of the peace because you're potentially antagonizing the crowd. It's quite clear who is in the wrong and who is in the right here. If you're being antagonized by someone being openly Jewish, you are anti-Semitic. And clearly, this man is not the problem. And you know, that's just one example of many. I could go on.
I completely agree with you. Chloe, I watched a longer video of Gideon Falter, and it seemed evident to me that he was there to try and provoke a reaction. And of course, he denies that. He absolutely does. But I also, and I agree with you about, we have to be so careful, don't we, about those snippets we see on social media, because they can become everything when in fact, we need to see them in context. But what I also saw yesterday was a video of Lawrence Fox, a former actor, who's recently lost a series of sort of court cases. But I saw a video of him literally jabbing this young cop and actually like swearing to his face, F off, F you. Now, I thought that was two-tier policing, because I thought, look at that. That's the utter privilege of being born into a wealthy acting family. And you, as a privileged man, can stand in front of a cop and tell them to F off. I'm not sure that somebody from a pro-Palestine protest would be able to get away with that. What do you think?
I would agree that I think Lawrence Fox is often too abrasive. I don't think that he is a very good spokesperson for the right, to be honest. I know a lot of people who agree with me politically and they love Lawrence Fox, but I'm not a huge fan because, you know, he does sort of give this sort of posh Tory twat image, as the stereotype often shows. And obviously, Lawrence has had run-ins with the police sort of coming in and invading his home, and so he can't stand them for those reasons. So clearly, he's got some anger with the police. But I don't think you should fight fire with fire. I think if you don't like the police, you know, and you want to reason with them, you should do so in a calm, reasonable manner. I think that the police need to actually just crack on with just enforcing the law rather than worrying about their reputation, because you've got perhaps them not pushing back against Lawrence Fox because they saw the backlash that Lawrence created and how he pushed all over social media when they came to his home before, and they might think, we don't want the bad press again. Similarly, you have them standing back, I think, at Palestine protests, and you had Muslim crowds celebrating the end of Ramadan, throwing rubbish at the police, breaking out into riots, and the police just sort of standing back, not doing a whole lot. I do think they're worried, or if we go after a crowd that isn't white or is Muslim, we might be branded as racist or Islamophobic or something like that. It is difficult for the police because we are now
everybody
has their phones out and is filming, which didn't used to be the case. So you can understand the hesitancy, but they do need to forget about the backlash and just crack on with enforcing the law, because I do feel like the law is enforced very inconsistently at the moment. And that's very dangerous, because then people simply don't know what is acceptable and what is not. So people have to live in fear that, you know, the slightest thing might get you arrested. Meanwhile, someone else will do something horrific and get away with it.
I agree with you, actually. I think that is the problem, is that the police need to remember that they need to police without fear or favour. That is the reality, isn't it? They've become so captured. Let me ask you a question. Do you think that St. George's Day should become a bank holiday?
Ooh, good question. Yes, probably. But on the other hand, we do have quite a lot of bank holidays, and it would be interesting to see what the economic impact of that is. I mean, I can't remember the exact stats, but there was quite a significant impact, for example, of just the train strikes, when we had that flurry of train strikes over and over again. The days off work that caused apparently had quite a significant impact on our economy. So maybe if we keep on adding more and more bank holidays, we'll hinder economic growth. Not that there's much of it. I'm sure that the English would appreciate it at a time when they feel like being English is considered a crime. I mean, it seemed like the Met Police yesterday thought that you're far right if you carry an English flag. You saw them put out on Twitter warning us, oh, there are patriots coming down. These must be far right football hooligans. How do you know someone's political view and they're an extremist just because they've got a St. George's flag around their neck? It's just really...
Yeah, no, that's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. It's demonization of people. But clearly there were problems there yesterday, and it didn't look very patriotic to me, frankly, Chloe. Now, talk about something else which just is devastating. The migrant deaths in the Channel. Three men, a woman, 7-year-old girl die as smugglers cram more than 100 onto a boat. Chloe, any idea what we can do about this situation?
Well, the the simple answer is we need to stop the boats to stop this from happening. I think that when we see tragic stories like this, I think it really shows the human side of this problem. I think a lot of the time people saying stop the boats are portrayed as sort of anti-immigrant racists who don't care about people fleeing unsafe countries. But actually, there is a very human side to this, and it is that we don't want people to lose their lives in the channel because of criminal gangs who have put them on boats who simply do not care about their well-being. 100 people on a dinghy, I mean, I know some of these are quite big dinghies, but 100 people is so incredibly unsafe.
This doesn't bear thinking about, does it? It doesn't bear thinking about the level of desperation. We absolutely need to go after those criminal trafficking gangs. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And finally, it looks as though the Welsh government may reverse their 20-mile-per-hour speed limits by the end of the year. Chloe, tell me, does this mean sanity is finally being restored?
This is actually a really hopeful story. When this 20-mile-per-hour limit came in, I couldn't believe how ridiculous it was. There was a lot of confusion when this came in as to where exactly these 20 mile per hour speed limits would be. I remember making videos of it when it was first announced. And I was saying this is every built up area, i.e. anywhere where you've got lampposts less than 200 yards apart or less. And everyone was saying, no, of course not. It's only going to be in town centres. But I was right. And it did end up everywhere where you've got lampposts less than 200 yards apart. And there are plenty of roads with those lampposts where there aren't any houses or shops or buildings in sight and barely any pedestrians anywhere, and you're having to go along at 20 miles per hour. It's absolutely ridiculous. The law makes no sense. And it was very much this sort of top-down policy imposed on everyone where, you know, it just didn't really feel very democratic in that sense. And the fact that pressure groups have been able to have the power to get government to reconsider this actually shows that maybe people do have a voice. Maybe democracy does still work to some degree.
Oh, I like that. I like that. What a positive, hopeful note that is. I mean, I don't know if you drive. I drive. But what I can absolutely categorically say is sometimes these very low speed limits are more problems. They create more problems than they resolve. They're dangerous. People get really impatient, don't they? And start overtaking in very narrow areas because they're angry. They want to get moving. So it is very comforting, isn't it, when pushback can lead to some sort of positive resolve in a situation like this. Does that give you hope?
It does give me hope, definitely. Now, as you say, it can cause problems having these 20 mile per hour speed limits. I think that's what the review of that has shown. You've got a lot of road rage going on, as you've suggested. I think that it's hard to measure, but I don't think this is any better for the environment, as some people seemed to be suggesting when this first came out. I mean, I don't know about other people, but for me personally, if my car is going at 20, it's revving quite high in second gear. But if I put it in third gear, the engine struggles. So I'm definitely revving much higher at 20 than I would be at 30. Now, of course, you can make the argument that this will save lives, but it is unreasonable. It's not in proportion. It is reasonable in a town centre, but it is not reasonable on a road where there's just barely any pedestrians in sight. If we take the argument, oh, driving at 30 causes some deaths, therefore nobody should drive at 30, you may as well just ban driving altogether. If cars are on the road, people will end up in crashes and people will die. But you've got to have a cost-benefit analysis and look at the benefit of people being able to get places quicker, get to work, and so on, and weigh that up.
It would be lovely to think that this was the end of the war on the motorists, which we know has been taking place. Does it feel like that to you to a degree?
I think it's a step in the right direction, for sure. And of course, we've seen huge, huge backlash against ULEZ, which has been expanded in London very, very controversially. You see huge protests going on constantly. I think people are doing a really good job there. And I think that that will help prevent Khan from taking this any further. Sadly, I do think he will get re-elected and we'll be stuck with it. But it might...
Chloe, we were on such a positive note, Chloe. You've just taken us down, Chloe.
I'll give you a more positive note, which is that we were hearing suggestions that ULEZ will be brought out in cities across the country. But exactly. I think the backlash against Khan means that it will be very, very difficult for them to do it in other cities across the country.
That is a positive note. What a girl she is, everybody. This is Chloe Dobbs, political commentator. Thank you so much, Chloe. Have a wonderful Wednesday. Of course, stay with us. We will be right back after 9 a.m. with so much more. Do not go anywhere. See you shortly.